Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
And good morning, 5:11. Welcome to your Thursday. Steve Grzanich is off this week, but he did get to sit down with a commercial real estate leader, which is, commercial real estate's had an up and down year, but what is always guaranteed is that there's change on the horizon. Steve sat down with Greg Warsick. He's the SVP and Senior Regional Manager for the Chicago market for commercial real estate and Associated Bank, and he's also a thought leader in the conversation. Greg and Steve covering the changes in the market and, of course, what's on the radar coming up for 2018.
Greg, good morning. Welcome back to The Opening Bell.
Thanks, Steve.
Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the commercial real estate market. The last time you were in, we saw some data that suggested a little weakness in the market. Does that still exist?
Yeah, we're... You know, last time we talked, it was, there's been some softness in the market. Vacancy is starting to creep up a little bit. Rates are expected to soften a little bit just because there's a fair amount of product coming online. And a lot of tenants are starting to, you know, renew, move, and take less space than what they currently have.
I still look at the skyline and see all the buildings going up and the new construction around the area. Those are going to be nice, shiny, new, lots of them offices. Are we going to have people to put in them?
You know, that's a great question. These new office buildings, and we're involved with a few of them, are very well designed. They have robust IT layout in them, and they're very efficient. And so tenants are very interested in making the moves to these buildings, and a lot of them are located, you know, in the West Loop near transportation, near the train station. So that's a big positive. But what we're seeing is that as new tenants move into these buildings, because they're so efficient, and a lot of these companies are moving, leveraging the technology that's come to play in their businesses, that they're actually taking a lot less space. So I think that's part of the driver in vacancy starting to take off, because you have tenants moving, say, from 500,000 square feet in the Central Loop into one of these new buildings at 300,000 square feet. So it looks good on the surface, but your net absorption is actually a negative 200,000 in that example.
One of the industries that's sort of peeling back is the legal industry, the law firms that are kind of cutting back on the amount of space that they have. How big of an impact in the Chicago market is that having on space?
You know, it's I think it's having a pretty significant impact. In fact, I think over the next 5 years, it'll be even more significant, because a lot of those law firms, their leases, looking at a recent CBRE study, show that over 5 million square feet is going to be expiring or maturing with large law firms in Chicago. And like most big cities, the big law firms tend to be in these Class A office buildings, and historically have been big users. But like everybody else, their business is changing largely due to technology.
You know, part of the technology, and we've reported here on The Opening Bell before, artificial intelligence is taking over some of the work, where you have things that machines that read all of these files that law firms don't have to. I think the report you mentioned earlier, this CBRE report, had a couple of local examples. One law firm cut its space by 42%, another by 37%. So that's pretty big.
Yeah, and some of those law firms are moving from buildings in the Central Loop into some of those West Loop buildings that we were talking about. And if you think about, you know, the law firms and how their business has changed, you know, law libraries, it's all digital.
Yeah.
Don't need it anymore. All the filing space that those places used to need, and people to sit at desks and actually do the filing, all digital, all online. Where the people are located, a lot of large law firms are offshoring the paralegals or embracing telecommuting. So if you add it all up, you know, in the meeting space, we know a lot of law firms over the years where they'd have full floors of just meeting space, it's all going to Skype, teleconference. Mm-hmm. Nobody gets together anymore. So you put all that together, and all of a sudden these huge blocks of space that the law firms used to require is now significantly lower.
What are some of the other industries, if you had to rank them in Chicago, that take up the office space besides the law industry?
Boy, that's a good question. You know, my answer might have been different a couple of years ago, but one of the big things that we've seen is, you know, in kind of an equalizer, is that there's a lot of large corporations that are moving downtown. So a lot of the suburban players that used to, you know, have large complexes out in the burbs are now moving downtown to be by the talent. So that mix is a little different. You see more Fortune 500 companies. I'm trying to think of who some of the recent big users are, but they're usually financial, I would say, would be the next big ones. You know, there's a new tower being slated to be built on Wacker at the GGP site, and that's going to be anchored by 500,000 square feet of Bank of America. So those are the big ones, not just the banks, but just the financial services area.
You mentioned the telecommunicating aspect of this. I saw a report, and I know we talked about this before, about companies, big companies, now pulling back the reins on telecommuting, having their people come into work now. Do you think that will maybe turn the tide a little bit on this?
No, I don't know if it will or not. I've read some recent studies on that as well, where some companies are starting to feel like it's hurting the engagement, that there's too many employees that are out and that you lose too much. And so there is this shift in some industries to pull back that telecommuting and bring people back into the office more frequently or permanently.
Trust is another. I think I saw the same story you did, where companies too are not really trusting their employees that they're really doing the work at home.
Well, it's a lot harder to gauge, you know, when people are actually working versus when they come in at, you know, 8 to 5.
Yeah. Let's talk about another story that's in the news that I thought was pretty interesting. As we see retail places shut down, there was an interesting court fight involving, I think, Starbucks and maybe Whole Foods, where they wanted to close stores, shut down retail locations, and the landlord of the company that was renting to them said, hey, wait, no, you have a clause in your contract that says you have to keep this open and operating. And they've lost that court case.
They did. That was a fascinating and unique situation, because, you know, what's really happening in the retail space right now, and it happens continuously, is there's always retail concepts that don't work. They fall on financial hard times. They don't have the cash flow or liquidity to continue, and they can't make payroll. They can't pay the rent. So you've got a tenant that basically you can't get the lease payments out of. In this case, it's a situation where, you know, Starbucks had 77 locations in the Simon REIT in their retail centers, and just said, you know, this concept really isn't working that well for us, and we're going to close these operations. It doesn't say anything about defaulting on the lease, but they're halting operation. Well, a retailer the size of, you know, Simon with 77 locations, the last thing they want is any tenant to go dark in this environment. It tends to have a ripple effect that makes the other tenants uneasy, and they went to court and said, look, your lease says you have to stay open, and they have the financial capacity to do that. And so they won. And in that other case you mentioned, Whole Foods, same thing. That was a single location, but an interesting trend.
Yeah, and it made me wonder how many of these lease agreements like this might be around, especially here in the Chicago area. I've seen a lot of Starbucks and Whole Foods stores starting to close or change or do something different. Is this a cookie cutter approach, or are these unique lease agreements?
That's not a unique lease agreement. That's pretty standard. And it's interesting, because usually it doesn't play out this way. If in both cases the tenants just closed the businesses and really didn't let the landlords know, what usually happens is a tenant lets the landlord know that they're having issues, that they will be closing, and usually it is a negotiated, sort of a consensual lease termination is what they call it. This is a very unique situation where they didn't do that.
Yeah. And two, you have two companies in Starbucks and Amazon that aren't hurting for money and funds. I'm wondering if in the Starbucks case, if they just are going to leave, you know, put a new Starbucks store there, or what's going to happen?
You know, they could, because the Teavana concept, they've not been thrilled with how it's performed. But that is another option, is probably a Starbucks.
If you had to look ahead to 2018, what would you say would be the trends in commercial real estate that we might see?
You know, I wouldn't say the trend to me right now is sort of Amazon-like. It's the disruptors. It's keeping up with the digital future, if you will, and the impact on commercial real estate. And there's things that are changing, which frankly make my job very interesting. But at the same time, I'm trying to learn through my clients, the commercial real estate developers, what's coming, what are they seeing, because it's changing rapidly. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I feel like the last couple years, it's moving in different directions, and it's moving rapidly. So the trick when you're doing construction loans, building, you know, financing new things, is trying to stay ahead of what's coming. I'll give you an example. Like for apartments, we're seeing more micro units, smaller units, keeping the price down. It's the affordability. There's no parking in these new buildings. They're all TODs. You know, most of the tenants, especially millennials, no cars. They're using alternative transportation. So it's trying to stay ahead of all those trends. From a lending perspective, is the biggest challenge. And for my clients, trying to stay ahead of it as well.
Still, though, we see in so many different areas, with consumer confidence, small business confidence, corporate confidence, it seems like everybody's optimistic, at least going into the new year, about the opportunities.
There's definitely optimism. There continues to be concern about financial issues that are looming for the city and the state. I have more and more clients that tend to be looking outside of Illinois for opportunities. But generally speaking, people are still positive going into 2018.
Looking outside of Illinois to move or to expand?
To expand. So you have Chicago-based developers that traditionally have developed in Chicago and have become concerned. Especially the looming real estate tax increases that could be coming. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my clients are starting to look at other markets.
And the suburban areas versus the metropolitan areas, are we going to see more action in the suburbs, do you think?
It's possible. I mean, you know, as it relates to real estate taxes, you start saying, okay, maybe you get on the right side of DuPage or Lake County from Cook County. I think that's where there's a lot of concern, and it's not just local. It's people coming into the market when they look to buy in Chicago. They ask if the property is in Cook County or not.
Interesting. Best to you for the new year. It's good talking with you as always.
As always, Steve. Thank you.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Happy holidays to everybody. Mark Carman sitting in for Steve Krasanich here on The Opening Bell. Let's learn about identity theft, which I think we're all terrified about. Heather Wagenhals, who you've seen on CNN, NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox. She's a tech analyst as well, but here to talk identity theft with us this morning. Heather, good morning. Thanks for being on WGN.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. I wish it was a more pleasant topic.
Well, that is a good point, but let's tackle this. I want to start with passwords, because everybody's got that, at least I have, the remembering problem. If I'm going to have my email password and my password for my bank and my password for this credit card and my password for my XYZ account, and I can't remember them all, so I'm going to keep them all as one, which I think is unique and creative. How dangerous is that part for identity theft? Am I setting myself up for something terrible?
It's beyond dangerous. I mean, you know, you risk your entire financial life when you do that, when you create one singular password. Even with some of these password lockers, you know, there's a lot of different apps that come up for your phone to make it easier for you. This is one of the challenges that we have as individuals, as human beings, because, you know, this is what we talk about on my Unlock Your Wealth radio show, is that we are biologically driven towards pleasure and away from pain. And so this, on a subconscious level, affects our conscious decisions. So you think you're doing a really good job because now you have one thing to remember and that you can use it for everything, so it'll make it quick and expedient. But what you're really doing is you're setting yourself up for a massive attack. If somebody just gets into one website, and it doesn't have to be an important one, it can just be some social media website, And now they have the keys to the castle. They can go and become you quickly. Drain your bank accounts, rack up new credit card charges, whatever. And that's the risk that you're putting yourself with just a singular password for everything.
All right, Heather, I got to go and make some changes here. I appreciate you coming on WGN. I'm kidding. All right, I hear you. The fear has been lifted. What about as far as, I don't know, the federal do not call list? Is that important? I get the telemarketing calls. Who are these people? What are you talking to me about? Are you trying to get information? I don't trust you. Should I get on the do not call list? I mean, how important is that? Or is that just a nuisance that I don't really need to worry that something bad is happening?
Well, the ironic thing is the challenge when you get on the do not call list is it blocks legitimate businesses from contacting you with possible goods and services. It does nothing to protect you if you are dealing with scam artists. That's usually what makes the phone ring. So unfortunately, you know, you're not protecting yourself against the people that you really need to be protected from, because, you know, it's annoying to get phone calls, you know, for people, you know, soliciting charitable donations or, you know, trying to sell you goods and services legitimately. But you're not protected, you know, because they're spoofing phone numbers anyway when they do the fraudulent thing. And so it doesn't help you in that respect, but it'll keep the legitimate business people at bay. So it is worth your time to do that. On that do not call list, it'll cut part of the calls down, but it won't solve them all.
This is why you're here, Heather. Of course, it doesn't matter what I just heard there. If I'm on that list, the people that are trying to get at me are not on the do not call list.
Not the criminals.
Right, right. Okay. What about your credit report? I mean, people, should I be checking that? Should I be asking Equifax or Experian or TransUnion? Or is that like opening me up? If I'm calling at least once a year to find out what's going on, is that somehow, some way opening me up to people getting my information?
Not when you're checking it yourself, as long as you're doing it in a secure fashion. So if you go online using a secure browser and you surf over to the government website that allows you that free credit report per year, if not, and you forgot a big one, that there's another major repository that people are checking, and that's Innovis, INNOVIS.com.
Right.
There's four big boys, not three. And so we should be vigilant. If you use credit, you should be doing it more often than that. But the biggest thing that you can do to protect yourself against fraudulent use of your identity in the credit realm is to freeze your credit. It seems annoying, and it goes against our biological drives because that's a lot more work, so that's going to be a pain in my butt. But even the most sophisticated investors, you know, I am a real estate investor, so I'm applying for mortgages all the time. I have my credit frozen. And so, yes, it's a pain in the butt because you got to call the day before they go to pull your credit. But now some of the different repositories, it looks like, are moving toward a switch on an app. So if you've got a secure connection, you can flip it on and off at will. And even with, you know, that, it's arduous, and that's why people don't do it. It's not that we don't know to protect ourselves against identity theft, frauds, and scams. It's just work, and I got to drop the kids off at school and pick up my husband's dry cleaning, and I got to make stuff for the bake sale on the weekend. And, you know, so we get caught up in life, and we don't take the steps that we should take.
So if you freeze your credit report, then the only time you can get it, if you're going to apply for a mortgage or anything like that, you have to unfreeze it. And then once that process is done, you freeze it back up again. That's what you're saying?
Yes, just so they can pull the credit, so they can verify. Otherwise, it'll kick back a null number, and it won't give you a credit score, and it won't give them access to see what's inside the report.
Okay.
So that's why you want to unfreeze it for that. But, I mean, it's worth it because, you know, at least people won't be able to open up new accounts. It doesn't protect you completely from all identity theft, but at least you can thwart that part in the credit realm. If they've got your information, they could be draining bank accounts and doing other things without your knowledge. But that's one thing that you can do to at least protect the credit portion, to keep yourself from owing a ton of people money.
And you're calling one of the big four to do that, Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. That's what you're doing. You're not calling your actual credit card company.
Correct. You need to call them all.
Okay.
Not just one of them.
Okay.
Because Because not every state requires a three bureau or four bureau credit pull to make a credit determination. So every state has a major repository, and then they may use the other ones. And so what you want to do is make sure that you've got your bases covered and blanket them all.
What I'm hearing here, Heather, is that we're up against our own laziness. That's the biggest problem.
Exactly. You know, because if you think about it, you know, it's not that we don't know to save more and spend less, but we don't. That's why in this month we're going to see the ramifications of our behaviors to Christmas time. It's the same thing with identity theft, frauds, and scams. We already know what to do. The steps are out there. You know, you can go to the Federal Trade Commission. You can go to identitytheft.gov. There are checklists that you can download. This information is available on my website, moneycreditandyou.com. But we just don't do it. We don't take the time because we make an excuse. We do it later. But the problem with later is later never comes because it, when it gets here, it's now again.
Yeah. You can also buy, Heather, you have a book, Money, Credit, and You as well, How to Avoid Identity Theft, Frauds, and Scams. Visit moneycreditandyou.com if you want to get the book as well, and you can find more information there. All right. I'm sitting in Starbucks, Heather. I'm thinking about checking my bank account. I'm on a public Wi-Fi. But it's I have my own laptop, right? Is that legal, or is that a terrible decision?
It's completely legal, but it is a terrible decision also because, you know, you are transmitting, you know, sensitive information. And the problem is that I could take my little MiFi device that I have. I bring a secure connection when I go to Starbucks or any other type of place. And I set my own Wi-Fi down. I can change the name of my Wi-Fi. So I could make my personal device say Starbucks free Wi-Fi. And then you hop on it because it pops up in your thing, and you're not even using the legitimate Starbucks Wi-Fi. You're using mine, and now I can see everything you're doing when you're on my Wi-Fi. So that's, you know, a bigger issue. It's not just that it's public, but you might not even be on the right network because it could be spoofed.
Okay. Thieves out there, please don't listen to what Heather just said because that sounds like... That seemed like some great advice.
They already know.
They do. Okay. All right. One more for you, Heather, and then I'll let you get out of here. I'm being told that do not use your debit card outside of an ATM. Like if you're going to Target or whatever and you're going to buy your milk, don't use your debit card there and get $20 along with your milk. That's a bad idea. Is that true?
If this were a quiz, you finally got 100% right on this one. Question. You do not want to use your debit cards for anything because it does not offer you the same consumer protections as a credit card. When you spend money on the debit card, it's gone. Okay? And now you're chasing it to get it back. And the window is only 48 hours. Otherwise, you're liable up to $50 minimum on whatever the transaction was. And if you're, you know, even though chip and PIN is supposed to be the deal, we have chip and sign, and that's a good way to mask your account number. But again, if it's a debit card transaction, the money is gone. With a credit card, you protect yourself. You have a dispute process, and you're not out the money until the credit card company proves you owe it, which is so much better for you. And you know, and when you swipe with that magnetic strip, and as opposed to dipping it with the chip portion, you're giving away your actual account information in that magnetic stripe. That's why the chip is so critical, and many retailers still aren't using them, and that's a big problem.
I've never gotten 100% ever, Heather. I feel way better about myself.
I allowed you to make up, you know, for all of the dings that you got along the way. This is the bonus question, and you made up for all of the mistakes right there. That's a huge one, and people don't realize it because there's other financial gurus out there that are saying, use your debit card, cut up your credit cards. You know, that's a discipline issue, and you shouldn't be jeopardizing your financial future because you are worried about overspending on your credit cards. I think that's malarkey. You need to use credit cards for everything.
Heather Wagenhals, Certified Identity Theft Risk Management Specialist. Check out her website, moneycreditandyou.com. Heather, appreciate the information. Great stuff. Thanks for coming on.
The pleasure was mine, Mark. Make it a prosperous day.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning, 5:53. Pete McMurray coming right up. I'm seeing him disinfect the studio downstairs right now like no one has ever gotten it done. Looking forward to talking to Pete coming up here in a moment. This is the opening bell. Steve Grzanich off this week. Let's look at our pre-markets. The Dow futures looking like they are trending up this morning. About 45 points, 24,774. S&P futures also up a couple of points, 2682.62. The NASDAQ is up 17 points this morning at 6471 and a quarter. The Russell trending forward as well. Asia markets are trending up, as is Europe as well. Europe is a little more mixed this morning. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities. Here's Orion.
Good morning, everyone. Well, as we wind down the year 2017, we're certainly seeing an impact on trade in the agricultural markets. Winter wheat futures climbed more than 1% yesterday. Corn was higher for the sixth straight session. Technical buying and end of the year positioning helping grain prices. Soybean futures, on the other hand, turned lower because it rained over the weekend in Argentina, and conditions improved from a weather standpoint for the soybean crop in Argentina. March wheat settled up 5¾ cents, $4.28 a bushel. March corn was up a penny at 3¾ cents a bushel. Turning to the livestock trade, lean hogs at the Mercantile Exchange declined from 10-month top on lower cash prices because the profit-taking came to play. Less money paid by packers for the cash hog market. February hogs closing a half dollar lower at $71.02. And the cattle, the December contract will expire on Friday, and it closed up 52 cents a pound at $122.02. So it's end of the year positioning ahead of New Year's Eve, and keep in mind the markets will close at noon Friday and remain closed till 8:30 a.m. on Tuesday. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thank you, Orion. The weekly U.S. crude inventories report is out today at 10 in the morning Central Time. And tomorrow, Friday, Russia will report their latest quarterly GDP.